I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source. Benjamin Zander is giving us the maestro's tour around Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 9, which he will conduct in Boston Symphony Hall tomorrow night. This is the last big piece Mahler finished in 1909. It's the symphony that documents, in one particularly irregular musical phrase and drumbeat, just what was wrong with the rhythm of Mahler's heart. He wrote the piece under a sort of death sentence, and then died in 1911 without ever hearing it performed. But it lives on near the center of the concert repertoire as a heart-rending farewell to life and a foretaste of a century of breakdown and trouble ahead, starting with World War I. This is the symphony that opens with music that is close to silence, and it closes an hour and a half later with the still more extended, almost endless hush of strings. We're listening here to the fourth movement in a passage with clarinets, flutes, and then French horns that marks a sort of start of the decline, the beginning of the end. Benjamin Zander is conducting this performance with the Philharmonia Orchestra. I was waiting for those French horns, Ben. But all of that music makes you want to live, doesn't it?
Actually, that's right. It isn't about death. It is about life. It's certainly about a farewell. But I think it points towards life. There's such deep sadness and a sense of love of life. The great melody that's coming up in the horn, if you wanted to say in some way, thank you for life, a fulfilled gratitude, it would be the sound of this horn solo. Nobody has been able to say thank you for life more eloquently, more powerfully, and more movingly. In fact, no words can possibly reach our hearts the way that that music does. And it makes us feel just gratitude, a sense of acceptance, of joy. A passion for life is in this music.
Ben, among other things, we're grateful to you for the Boston Philharmonic over 35 years. And I say that not to flatter, but we owe you. We owe you, too, for this music and bringing us back and back. How many Mahler 9s is this for you?
Well, with the Boston Philharmonic, it's four. And it's very interesting what those four are. The first one was a dramatic event. It was in 1978. I was conducting another orchestra, the Civic Orchestra, and Jordan Hall was packed as it is never packed today because there were no fire laws in those days. So the seats and the staircases and every space in that hall was occupied by an avid crowd of people hungry to hear that music. At the end of that performance, I was fired as the conductor of the Civic Symphony Orchestra, because the board, the people who were leading the orchestra, hated the music. And I think it's important to realize that how far we've come in these 35 years, because at that time it was almost unknown, hadn't been played, and the person who was in charge of the board said, if anybody had known what rubbish that was, there wouldn't have been a single person in the hall.
So that view is still out there. I don't know that we'll get to it tonight, but there is some sort of an argument. And the Brahms lover in me wants to speak sharply to Gustav Mahler about some of this music. But that maybe that's over my
but
out of my depth anyway.
At the end of that experience, we had 22 rehearsals. We had 3.5 months of preparation, and that one great experience of going through that symphony, which many people in the orchestra remember, because when I was fired, the whole orchestra resigned and we went on together. That's how the Boston Philharmonic started. So it started out of the Mahler Ninth.
I'm dying to know, Ben, how this 35 years later is a different experience. It's sort of like a man in his 50s playing King Lear and then playing it again in his 80s.
Absolutely.
How is it different that listeners, alert listeners, can hear? How is it different in places in you that we'll never see?
Well, it's become part of my being. You see, when we did it for the first time, I didn't know the piece, and they didn't know the piece, and we were learning it in those 22 rehearsals, hour after hour, looking over every bar and trying to understand it. And if you look at my score, every bar is annotated. And now, it's part of my being. I think that way. I hear it. I don't even have to do anything anymore. It's just the way the music goes, and I'm part of it, and I feel enormously privileged to speak that language. I say without an accent. In other words, this is my language.
You made a wonderful comment a few years ago. You were speaking about Wagner and saying of all the people, living or dead, real or imaginary, that you'd love to have lunch with, Richard Wagner was it. And somebody responded to you, Ben, after all these years with Mahler, you wouldn't have lunch with Mahler? And you responded, as I remember, wait, I've been having lunch with Mahler all my life.
Yes.
I want to
know. Well, that's a slight exaggeration, but in a way, we musicians live our lives through the experience of the music. We think we know these composers. I don't think anything about Mahler would surprise me so if I spent a lunch or a week with him, because, first of all, his life has been documented to a degree that almost nobody else's has been. We know everything about him because Henri-Louis de Lagrange and Donald Mitchell and all the books, but also everything is in the music. He's explained himself so completely.
Who's the guy you talk to in the middle of the night or in the middle of the symphony? And what do you ask him? I mean, this was a man, among others, who, not a typical composer, who left a lot of latitude for the conductor, and he wanted to see where you would take his work. But
you mean Mahler?
Yes.
No, well, you see, in a way, I don't think he left so much to the
conductor.
He wrote it. He wrote so many instructions, so much help to the conductor about tempo, about phrasing, about dynamics, about the kind of character he wanted from the music. I think it's crystal clear, and all I have to do is turn it on, and my hands and my body and my face and my eyes is the music. When I'm on, I mean, one isn't that way all the time, but I feel that way about the Ninth Symphony. I don't have to think about it. It's speaking for me. I think it's speaking for all of us in a way that very little music does.
But is it his annotations? Is it his voice? Is it his famous neurotic conflicts? The man who said he was three ways homeless. I mean, he was a bohemian in Vienna. He was a Jew in the world, and he was a
an Austrian.
Austrian in New York, too.
Yes. But, you know, there's also a sense in which he was home, in the sense that he created the environment of the end of the century. I mean, he was the most dominant figure. He was, after all, the emperor was less famous than he was. I mean, when he died, the train line was lined with people all the way to Vienna from Paris. He was a great figure and loved and admired and also feared and hated. And there was anti-Semitism, surely, but he was also revered as one of the greatest creative artists of all time. And he wrote music which has become the universal experience which we turn to. I mean, there are very few pieces of music, maybe the B minor mass, the Don Giovanni, you know, that take you to a different world, that deal with the most profound issues that human beings are dealing with, a feeling and a sense of the beyond, the transition, facing death. And the beauty is everyone can feel it. This is the amazing thing about Mahler. This is not an esoteric composer who appeals to a few people. He's become the central figure in the musical repertoire. And I have a lovely story, which means so much to me. When we did a performance, the second performance with the Boston Philharmonic, I sent out a tape to the members of the orchestra because it's very difficult music, and I wanted them to study it before the first rehearsal. And one of the members, who's still playing in the orchestra, took the tape on holiday with her. And she was playing it on her boombox, and her niece, who was 5, said to her, "What is this music about?" And so she told a story about a princess and a prince and ogres, and also invented a fairy story for her about this piece. The next day, she said, "Can we listen to the piece about the prince again?" And so they listened to it again. And then the third day, in the middle of the performance, she said, "Auntie Anne, what is this piece really about?" Mm. And then Auntie Anne told her about Mahler and his feelings, his experience, the loss of his 7 brothers and sisters, and the terrible struggle between his parents and the cruelty and the drunkenness, but also the incredible energy. And he was a sportsman. He was very... All of that is in the music. And so the next day she said, "Can we listen to the piece about that man again?" They listened to it each day. Then she took the tape home. Her mother said she listened to it over 100 times. She came to the concert, drove 4 hours with her parents from upper New York State, and then wrote me a letter. She said, "Ben Zander," at the top, with the R pointing the wrong way like Toys R Us, she said, "Thank you for Mahler 9th. I loved it." Now, this is a 5-year-old.
And this music we're going to the break on is from a sort of sprightly end of the second movement of Mahler 9. When we come back, the Mahler Century. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about Gustav Mahler's 9th Symphony this hour with the maestro Benjamin Zander. We're listening here to the start of the second movement, which feels to me, Ben, like a sort of nostalgia tour, scenes from a country childhood. I put it to the listeners, is this your childhood? Is this your Mahler? Join the conversation with Benjamin Zander at 800-423-8255. Where are we going, Ben?
Well, this is a danse macabre. He wrote on one of the other such dances, "Brother Death Dances It With Me." So these are Austrian dances, the Ländler, the waltzes, slow, fast, slow, slower, and then faster. What you hear is a sarcasm, a rustic grotesquerie. He wrote at the front, "Etwas teppisch und sehr derb," meaning rather clumsy and very coarse. Boorish, heavy-footed. Violins come in playing like fiddles, and then faster and faster waltzes, more and more frenetic. But the lilt has gone. This is not the elegant chandeliers and the beautiful dances of the waltz. The dance of life is seen as tawdry, pointless. No glittering chandeliers here. Elegance is gone. The music feels in a way locked and trapped, chained. There's an exhaustion, a despair in this music that is all part of the scene of the 9th Symphony, the final world.
So many of these phrases are incomplete, or they end in a sort of dissonance or off-key.
And then, of course, it gets frantic, faster and faster, like wild dervishes are dancing. It's frightening. It gets to a pitch of fury, and then sudden it lurches back. And we're back at the beginning again, which you played earlier, and it limps off into nowhere, fades away.
We'll get there, too. Ben, earlier today I spoke to Norman Lebrecht. He's the English culture buff and blogger who wrote Why Mahler? How One Man in 10 Symphonies Changed Our World. He spoke of Mahler's Ninth Symphony, coming right at that modern moment around 1910 when Virginia Woolf said, everything changed, including human character. That was a century ago. You could say Mahler wrote the 20th century. I put it to Norman Lorecht. Do Mahler and his music have another 100 years in them?
He had a sense, as did those around him. Picasso, Joyce, Einstein, they were reinventing the world. They were having to address a world that is reborn in the 20th century, but they were having to do it in a language that belonged to a previous world. Where does he go beyond the Ninth Symphony? Many people look upon the Ninth Symphony as the last word. They ignore the fact that he left a Tenth Symphony. He left it all but complete. And in the Tenth, he pushes tonality towards the edge of the cliff. There is one nine-note chord in the Tenth that is atonal in all but name and is one of the most shocking noises that you will ever hear in music. Mahler had a sense that he was entering a century of apocalypse, that although everything around him bespoke bourgeois comforts, Stefan Zweig, in his book about that period, The World of Yesterday, wrote that in Vienna at that time, everybody was prosperous. Cures were being invented every week for diseases. You put your money in the bank and it grew. It was a world of limitless confidence. And Mahler came along and said, we're on the edge of the cliff. We're going over. If we don't actually remedy this old world of falsities, we're heading for extinction. That's what the Ninth Symphony is about. That's what the Tenth Symphony is about. They are, in a certain sense, admonitory and prophetic. They call upon the world to mend its ways, to address both the physical realities and the emotional ones.
And that's why it's maybe bad news for all of us that the 21st century could be another Mahler century of edge of the apocalypse between climate change and raging inequality, starvation, hunger around the world. What's your thought about the apocalypse
here? I agree with Norman. I mean, Norman is one of the great voices for understanding Mahler and that period of time. He writes eloquently about it. I think the tragedy about Mahler is that he died so young. He died at 50 with the work unfinished. And we have no idea where he would have gone with that experience. What would have happened if he'd finished the 10th, written an 11th?
Right.
Would he have gone into atonal music? Would music history have changed completely? And nobody can tell what he would have done. But at the edge of the abyss, I think, is certainly what he saw. And the progeny that he had as a composer was monumental. Without Mahler, there would have been no second Viennese school. What would Schoenberg have done and Berg without that voice? So it's a gigantic figure, and he speaks for...
But even broader, Ben, in the sense of where would Hollywood be? I mean, John Williams is a child of Mahler. Leonard Bernstein's score for On the Waterfront was Mahler. Hitchcock's, was it Bernard Herrmann, was Mahler. Spielberg is, you know...
Malarian.
Totally Malarian in certain ways. But is it the sense of a still yawning abyss that makes him current even today, even in your audience?
I think he speaks to everybody. What the explanation of it is, I don't know, in terms of the future. I do know that he's the composer of the moment. It's clear. I mean, he's displaced Beethoven.
As he said he would. That's an amazing presumption.
He absolutely had a premonition about that. He said, in 50 years, it's actually 100 years, but it's become the central voice of our time. And thrillingly so. And it speaks of the fullness of life in all its manifestations, not just of despair and death.
Now we're back here in the first movement of the symphony. This is sort of the incredibly comforting, beautiful memory.
Well, there are two kinds of music in the first movement. There's music of hope and love and tenderness, and there's music of despair and anguish. This is the music of despair and anguish, struggling. This is the death music. And these two kinds of music vie with each other, and the despairing music grows more and more intense. There are five huge climaxes which grow and grow and grow as the music progresses. And as they progress, the music of tenderness and of love, the feminine, the mother, also grows more confident. And in the end of the movement, they come together, and it turns out that love and hate have the same theme. And there's a fantastic resolution at the end of the first movement that is one of the most moving moments in all of music.
Where do you classify that theme?
That's the hate theme.
Wow.
That rhythm, that hate. This is the second of the two climaxes.
And that movement in general is a kind of day at the beach compared to the third movement.
No. The first movement is the single greatest movement that Mahler wrote. It's 30 minutes long, and far from being a day at the beach, it plummets the entire gamut of human experience, from the darkest to the most tender, the most beautiful, the most intimate, the most loving, and also the most terrifying and frightening. Everything is in that first movement. In fact, at the end of the first movement, you think you've been through a whole symphony. It's the same length as the entire Beethoven Fifth Symphony, that one movement. And but the reason you can't just end there is because that resolution at the end has to be tested. And it's tested in the second and third movement in those dances. And then finally, at the end, we find a true resolution at the end of the symphony. It's a magnificently composed structure.
When I said a day at the beach, I was just thinking of the harshness of the contrast with the third movement, which the Leonard Bernstein version was the second movement was the country retrospective. The third movement is sort of the decadence of Vienna pierced and seen for what it is. But it certainly is the sound or the taste of a nostalgia tour gone sour. If we can hear a little bit of that third movement, is this not been a sort of portrait of anxiety?
Yes, it's ferocious in its intensity and savage, nihilistic, mocking, like staring into the abyss of horror. And we have to face it courageously. That's what it's asking us to do. The density of it, the intensity, the complexity of it. It leaves you nowhere to go. It crushes us, and as we listen, we should feel crushed by it. And as it goes into the end, it gets faster and faster and faster and goes over the edge into the abyss. I'm not sure that urban life is a sufficient image for that. I don't buy that image. I think this is a grotesque experience of intensity and pressure on human beings that is almost unbearable. And actually, at the end of the piece, today you were in the rehearsal, we took that end. It just got so fast that it was terrifying. I mean, it's madness itself. And it goes.
Ben, I was privileged to be in three rehearsals, and I think it was the first one you spoke of it as sort of how fast can this V8 engine or this stallion go, and when does the thrill of the speed, when does the danger of the chase exceed the thrill of the speed?
It's the danger of it. It's this looking over the edge of the abyss that is so terrifying in the Mahler, and that's the preparation. And here's the genius of Mahler. He takes a theme in the third movement, da 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 di poppy, which is a grotesque kind of manic giggle that appears on the clarinets, and it's on the screaming E-flat clarinet like a grotesque gargoyle. He takes that very theme and transforms it into the most tender, warm-hearted, generous, loving phrase at the opening of the last movement. I mean, that the music is all about transformation, about taking one thing and looking at it from a completely different angle. And for instance, in the dreamlike middle section of the third movement, where that appears, that the trumpet plays, it's the most beautiful dreamlike sequence. And that then becomes the tenderness of the last movement. So he's looking from the most obnoxious, most manic, most terrifying, grotesque world. Through that you can look. You have to go through that in order to appreciate, understand, and embrace the beauty of the resolution which we get at the end.
Speak of the architecture of this symphony, Ben, if you will. Leonard Bernstein, I would never dare say this, but he said, you know, the amazing thing is these are little cliches, one after another, and yet what he does with them is simply phenomenal. But even those fragmentary motifs that you're talking, they don't really amount, they don't add up to a Brahmsian melody or a Beethoven or Mozart melody.
Well, Beethoven in the late style is in the quartets, is writing motifs. He takes a motif, or for instance, in the Fifth Symphony, that's a ba-ba-ba-ba. That's ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.
A riff, they would say in jazz. Yeah.
Right. It doesn't make a melody. What Mahler is doing in this music is he takes, like for instance, at the opening of the symphony, he'll take this, it begins, boom, boom. That we think that's a representation of his heart because he'd been told that he was going to die of a heart condition, arrhythmic heart. That boom, boom, it's like an acorn. It grows a forest in the piece. The next thing, the harp, boom, 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 played very near the bridge, merciless, like a bell tolling. Then the horn, which is a noble, beautiful gesture, but because it's muted, it becomes suppressed. It's as if the nobility has been suppressed. Then the viola, and then this heavenly melody, tidy, so sad. You know, that these are motives which he then develops, each one an acorn, and produces a forest of development, of transformation, of taking. And you can see these elements everywhere in the music. It unfolds and grows, and it's like a forest of emotional beauty. And many of the emotions are simultaneous. I call that emotional counterpoint. That exists only in Mahler. The different instruments are playing different emotional statements, like in a novel. And to follow all that, to have a complete, to have the orchestra players feel the freedom to be that emotion when somebody else is doing something completely different.
I'm so glad it's you said it. The variety of voices in that band, clarinets, oboes, flutes. Not to mention the writing for cello, and of course, the writing for French horns. Who in the world wrote more marvelous things
and
for French horns?
And the beautiful thing about the 35 years that we've spent together is these players have become masters of the language of Mahler's music. They understand the deep emotional vocabulary of his life, and they know what they're doing. And that makes for a very vivid, colorful and deeply moving experience. Whereas if people are trained to play rather flat, to fit in with each other, that's the way orchestral players are trained normally, to be good citizens. And what I've been training them over the last 35 years to do is to be more and more individualistic. So the ideal orchestra is an orchestra of individuals listening and being part of a whole.
The individuality of those voices, Ben, in your band is extraordinary. Everything in the world reminds me of Duke Ellington, but nothing more than the way your players and Mahler wrote, as Billy Strayhorn wrote for Johnny Hodges, this is your voice.
Right.
You take it.
Right.
And what especially distinguishes Mahler, and maybe he was the breakthrough, but in jazz we think of Ellington as a band of incredibly strong
individual people allowed to be fully expressive of their individuality and what Mahler calls on them. And that, I think, is great Mahler playing. And the Philharmonia with which I'm doing the recording, the cycle, has the same attitude. And I tried, and my youth orchestra just went, you know, the new youth orchestra, the Boston Philharmonic Youth Orchestra, went to Holland, to the Concertgebouw, and played Mahler's Second Symphony. And people were stunned. Their hair was standing on, and they couldn't believe that this was the Mahlerian voice. They know it in Holland because of Mengelberg, and it was Mahler's home from home. They couldn't believe it. But this is what I focus my attention on, and bringing out all the voices and all their richness and complexity. And I stop at nothing till we get it right.
Well, and it's so much fun for us to see them again. Peggy Pearson and the...
Catherine Boyd.
Yeah. Catherine Boyd on the flute and Eric Berlin on the trumpet. All of these people
and Kevin Owen,
are remembered as sort of... Yeah. You come away thinking of them as
It's a great team. It's an extraordinary team, and I trust them completely to realize this music. And they're in heaven playing it. I mean, as our tuba, Don Rankin, said, I've played this piece in my life four times. Every time has been in this orchestra. And no other time has he played it, the tuba.
We're talking about Mahler 9 with Benjamin Zander, conducting Mahler's last great work, after 35 years of almost continuous Mahler. When we come back, we're going to hear what the audience hears in Mahler. And we'd love your call at 800-423-8255. We're listening here to the, as I say, sort of helter-skelter end of the third movement, conducted by Benjamin Zander and the Philharmonia Orchestra. I'm Christoph Leiden. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. We're talking about Gustav Mahler's Ninth Symphony this hour. We're listening to the final movement right here, the last gasp of the full orchestral sound heading downhill toward the terminal silence. Join the conversation with Ben Zander at 800-423-8255 is our phone. Jason is calling from Boston.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Ben.
Welcome, Jason.
So, Jason, hey. Are you coming to the concert tomorrow?
Oh, I definitely plan on it.
Great. Do you know that if anybody wants to come and get a ticket tomorrow at the door, rush tickets are $8. Can you imagine?
Oh.
To scale the heights and reach heaven for $8?
You may find me on the street corner with a bullhorn and a big placard telling people about this. Ben, you've been such an inspiration to me in my career trying to promote classical music.
Great.
As Chris may remember, I gave a series of talks on Mahler, and your TED talk was a major inspiration on that. So it's a treat to be able to talk to you guys. You said on one of them that classical music is for everyone, they just don't know it yet.
Right.
And one of the things I find so gripping about Mahler is that as complex as music is, it actually doesn't take, you don't have to know a lot of that stuff to really hear it. You know, you put it in front of someone and they get it.
Right.
I'm interested in if you could talk about bridge building, about how you bridge this music over to younger people who they might not know Beethoven. They may not get all the references, but there's something in the music that they can understand on a sort of visceral level.
Well, what you're talking about is what I call the unsuspecting. These are the people who didn't realize they were going to be profoundly moved by this experience. There are a couple of people coming to the concert tomorrow from my gym. Well, I meet them in the gym and I'm saying, get them to the concert. And I don't know what impact it'll have any more than I could know what impact it had on that 5-year-old who heard it. But, you know, there's another couple coming and I'm very interested. This is the woman is a very experienced musician, a composer and a pianist. And she told me that she'd heard my performance of Mahler's 9th 500 times.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The boyfriend she just met has never been to a concert. Now, they're coming tomorrow, and it's my job to make sure that this couple succeeds. And the only way they can succeed is if they understand it. So I've insisted that they come to my pre-concert talk, in which I, at 6:45 in the hall, I'm going to explain the music as best I can. I'll tell them how to listen, how to grapple with this extraordinary structure, what to listen for. And my absolute guarantee, I would say, at the end of this performance, is that he will come away saying to her, I love you, in your totality. See, that's the thing. Because this music is for everybody. You know, a woman came to a performance of the Mahler 9th at Jordan Hall, and she wrote me a letter, and I'll read you what she said. She said, you took me through a journey that I'd not expected was possible. I went tonight through life and death, love and fear, passion, torment, despair, and renunciation. My life has changed forever. Now, she's speaking for all human beings there, that all we have to do is to set a stage for them to experience this music, help them to understand it, and then play with all our hearts.
Speaking of the audience, Ben, here's a voice from the audience, not any old voice either, but the voice of Teju Cole, who closes his celebrated first novel called Open City in a performance of Mahler 9 at Carnegie Hall, Simon Rattle conducting the Berlin Philharmonic. I asked Teju Cole this week what he is feeling when this symphony ends.
Well, usually it ends and you're just hoping that everybody who's listening with you can just hold that space. This music has died out. I mean, it doesn't end with a bang. It dies out reluctantly, like one's last breath. And you just want everyone to hold that moment with you. Give it a few seconds, whether you are in Jordan Hall or in Carnegie Hall or in Symphony Hall or the Philharmonic in Berlin. You just want to be with that crowd in absolute silence so that you can all experience this together. You hope it's not one of those nights where there's some guy who is so eager to start clapping. So that's where I am at the end, which you get nowhere else in the culture, by the way, where you have a crowd who has not been instructed, who are all willingly being quiet for a few moments.
Teju Cole tells me that as a writer, as a creative person on the lookout, he feels Gustav Mahler's presence in Manhattan every day, in the subway, in the canyons, in the play of light and dark.
When something is shadowed, it's not just black in an undifferentiated way, but that there are places where the light then shoots through. And when something is bright, there are moments of shadow. And the architecture of our city makes us understand that, you know. The clouds are racing overhead, and you've got this sort of sharp distinctions of brightly lit streets and shadowed streets, you know, in late afternoon in Manhattan, for example. And that music is very much like that. There's actually no movement that doesn't have its happy bits and its melancholy bits and its massive and loud bits, and it's very quiet and intimate. This natural instinct for montage makes sense to the environment we function in. Life cannot be just one thing or another. You know, there was something about Mahler that, I can't quite remember if, did I read this somewhere? Am I making it up? But anyway, it's a story I love and I often hold on to, which was that, you know, his parents were having a terrific argument when he was a little boy. And, you know, and he was so distressed by this, he dashed out of the house and he went out into the street. And along came a man playing the hurdy-gurdy. And then this became a kind of example to him that the sublime and the ridiculous are always interspersed with each other in life, which is why the second movement of Mahler 9 is important. You know, I mean, suddenly, why are peasants dancing, you know, in the middle of this profound music? Because that's precisely how life is. You're at a funeral, and in the next moment, someone is dancing.
That was Teju Cole. Thank you, Teju Cole. The phone is 800-423-8255. 8255. We're talking about Mahler's Ninth Symphony with the maestro Benjamin Zander. The instinct for montage. Wonderful line that Teju just dropped in there. Maybe that's, is that what we're speaking about? These individual voices in and out, fortissimo, pianissimo, bending the phrase. It is a kind of it's crazy kind quilt of, in lots of places.
It's a kind of montage. It's all highly constructed. There's nothing chance about it. It doesn't have that found items of Braque and Picasso at all. It definitely comes out of Beethoven and Brahms and Wagner and the Bach, clearly out of that very highly structured tradition. He talked about the silence at the end of the symphony, and that's a very important part of the symphony. And at the last performance we did, the silence was not brief. It was 52 seconds before anybody felt they wanted to clap. And that tells you something about the experience. We had a wonderful member of our audience, a subscriber, who died of a heart condition. And she wrote to me just before a performance that we were doing. She said she couldn't come. She was too ill. But she described the end, the very last words, I mean, the very last notes of the piece. She says, the fade-out in the last movement of the ninth is the ultimate in coming to terms with our mortality, an acceptance of the inevitable, a blessing for all that has been, and a quiet sadness for what will not be. And 3 weeks later, she was dead. And that seems to me to describe as beautifully as one can what that music.
At peace,
can.
I'm sure.
Yeah,
Ben, we won't listen to the very, very, very end because
no.
People driving in their cars won't hear it. But let's tune in to that fourth movement where the protagonist, so to speak, in the symphony is approaching the end with all kinds of doubt and indecision and memory and a heartache and a sense of holding on one moment and letting go another. It's got to be a trial for the conductor. But take us through the musical language of this, so to speak, argument at the end of life.
Well, it's a long farewell, and it's a look back at life. It's calm, it's reassuring. The sadness is accepted, I think. It's a moment of tremendous generosity of spirit. Listen to that open-hearted, a courageous acceptance in the face of death. Listen to the sumptuous harmonies suggesting a consoling embrace. Mm. And the listener should feel embraced by this music. Majestic lines express a passion for life, fulfillment and gratitude.
Mm.
Nobody wants to say goodbye to a life like this. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
I always imagine Vladimir Nabokov, who was very coy about his religious belief, but he believed in saying thank you to whom it may concern. What about helplessness, regret, despair?
Well, this bleakness that comes in this very quiet music, stark chamber music sounds, expressionless, bleak, ethereal, static. And then this aloofness is in such contrast with the impassioned intensity of the passage we just heard. So this is music of extremes. Very high music, very low, very loud, very soft, very intense, very aloof, everything in between, all the emotions, all the panoply of human experience that we bring. And, of course, the more experience we have, the more this music speaks to us. My teacher said, Cassado, he said, you cannot play great music until your heart has been broken. And this is music for broken hearts.
Do we know biographically that Mahler had accepted his end?
Yes.
He knew it was coming?
Yeah. He knew it was coming. And he'd been told by his doctor. His doctor always had a doubt whether he should tell people, but Mahler insisted that he be told, and so he knew. And so he was able to plan his funeral. He designed his coffin, I mean his head, you know, the stone, which just says Mahler. He said people who come to see it, if they know him, they will know who he was, and if they don't, it doesn't matter. He planned his funeral. He wanted no music at his funeral.
My.
No music, and a bird sang in the roof, in the top of the tree, and it was like the bird in the end of the final movement of the Second Symphony, the final bird on earth. And so he had a chance to make peace with the world.
You tempt us to think about the music unwritten. His rival, so to speak, and friend after fashion, Richard Strauss,
yes,
lived till almost 1950,
yeah,
and was prolific.
Not so much at the end. But yes, I think, my friend David St. George said it's like Schubert. Schubert and Mahler have in common the fact that they didn't finish their work. Beethoven finished his work. Even Mozart, who died at 35, there's an early period, a middle period, a late period. We know that's a complete statement. And Beethoven, certainly, and Brahms. Mahler, we have no idea where he would have gone. 50 years old. And with so much energy and so much desire to continue composing. So it's a mystery and it's deeply sad.
Ben, we want to implore you to keep doing it forever. And I also just want to say, as an old friend of yours and a great admirer, it's what a joy it has been this week to be around the Boston Philharmonic, and how humbling it is not to know the language that you all work with,
yeah,
by a sort of second nature. But it's an extraordinary privilege just to be with you all.
And I want to tell you that we're happy that you're back.
Good. So many of your members wanted to say hello, and it was a joy. Thank you, Ben Zander. He will be conducting Mahler 9 tomorrow night at Symphony Hall. We're going out on the great farewell to the innocence of a bohemian boyhood from the end of the first movement. There's lots more on our website, longer excerpts of the conversations with Teju Cole, the novelist of Open City, and with the Mahler biographer Norman Lebrecht. There are also your own very thoughtful comments about Mahler at radioopensource.org. And there's a terrific conversation with the novelist Akhil Sharma. Next week, the French sensation, Thomas Piketty's blockbuster book on income equality. It's called Capital. It's the book everybody's talking about and nobody's read and no one can find in the bookstores. Our show this week was produced by Kunal Jasti, Max Larkin, and our engineer George Hicks. Maestros all. Mary McGrath leads our band. I'm Christopher Leiden. Join us next time for Open Source.